from deep inside the Death Star. I'm Chad Beter.
And I'm Andy Richards.
And welcome to Defrag Tools. We are here on location at Studio F.
Doing some Microsoft internals. Rather
Microsoft internals, yeah.
And I'm losing my voice.
And you're losing your voice. Great timing. You've been talking all morning, and now suddenly the camera rolls, and it's all over for Andrew's voice.
Yeah.
But here we are, and why are we in Studio F today, or outside Studio F today?
Which is my home territory, actually, my office.
Is this your building, too?
Yeah.
Oh, look at this. We're right in Andrew's building.
This is the home of fundamentals, which is everything to do with performance, battery, compatibility, crashes, me, everything to do with feedback, flighting, all that cool stuff, everything that makes Windows 10 awesome. So,
right.
But yeah, we're going to go and harass Gove, the host of Defrag. Defrag Show. I know you got that wrong.
Which our show is a spin-off of, thus the name.
But we're going to have a bit of a
Gove Maharaj.
Have a bit of a cross-pollination episode. The crossover episode.
Crossover. Oh, it's like when those TV shows have the crossover between the two characters.
Yeah, like,
oh man.
The Deep Space Nine episode where Star Trek.
Yeah, exactly.
Anyway,
exactly.
Let's go hit the road.
All right, let's walk in. Check it out.
Lobby.
Whoa, let's just come in here. All right.
All right. So
Studio F.
Studio F, this actually was the home for Windows Phone for years and years and years. And actually, if you look back in the archives, and we'll put a link below, this is the same building that Raymond Chen was in, but he's moved out and fundamentals moved in. Mm. So let's go into the middle of the Death Star and badge in. Right.
Buzz ourselves in here.
Whoa. Some cool Windows 10 leverage on the lifts, the elevators, whichever way you say it in America.
Oh, yeah, Windows 10.
And then we are going, I forgot where we're going. This way, we're going this way.
We're over here. Got to go find Gove's office. Barge on in.
Want to do a kitchen shot?
Kitchen.
Yeah, might as well, while we're here.
Need some coffee?
So while we're here, standing kitchen at Microsoft.
That's right. We got the famous Microsoft free soda, which has been a thing at Microsoft for what? Like as long as I've been here, probably since forever.
Since Bill. So Bill started it right at the start.
Bill Gates.
He's a Diet Coke man.
Yeah. He was in a commercial. Somebody can go look that up. I remember there was a Coke commercial with Bill Gates.
I remember
back when he needed the money, I guess, to doing ads.
At some point, I counted it, and there's like 48 types of can in there.
Right.
And I don't think we've got any custom ones right now, but we have. When there's something going on, we actually make custom cans with Microsoft.
Oh yeah, they do get those once in a while, like Windows cans
on
the soda water. All right.
All right.
Go find Mr. Gove Maharaj's office. See how he's doing today.
Everybody's closing their doors.
Yeah, don't mind us.
Don't mind
camera
us.
Crew in the halls. Here we are.
Here's the man, busy as always.
Busy, he looks busy, he's got his monitors all powered up. He's got Visual Studio up, so we'll interrupt him for a little while here. All right,
so for the people who haven't watched Defrag Show, which you should be ashamed of yourself, maybe. introduce who you are, at least.
My name is Gove Maharaj. I've been at Microsoft for about 16 years, originally from Canada, woohoo. There's a lot and yet not so much to tell about me. What kinds of things are you interested in learning about?
What jobs have you had at Microsoft? Has it been always the app compat world or?
I started with compatibility and I've been with compatibility for my entire tenure at Microsoft while working with other teams across the company for various issues.
So you would have started around Windows 2000, Windows very,
Me? The very beginning of XP.
XP?
Yeah.
That's cool. Nice. So how did the Defrag Show start? I mean, you started it, and then I had a conversation with Larry about how you don't really have the opportunity to deep dive into the tool that you use to help someone, and that's how the spin-off happened. How did that get started? I mean, how did this whole defrag concept formulate?
I think the whole reason for it to come about was just we had customers that, you know, wanted to learn more about how to diagnose their own failures. Mm. You know, we have so many various different ways of diagnosing failures out there, and people just need, you know, a human being to contact sometimes. You know, like online forums sometimes just aren't enough. Some of the questions, they actually need, you know, an internal person to go and, you know, gather up various pieces of information and then do some exploratory debugging. And it's really nice to have that customer connection. You know, it's unfortunate that I can't do it at scale. You know, that's kind of mm-hmm. what our support people are designed to do. But it's nice to be able to talk and interact with our customers and, you know, really feel some of the pain that they're going through and bring that back internally so that we can share that with the rest of the product teams.
Yeah.
So I like being one of the conduits for that, is really listening to our customers, seeing what their problems are. And there are literally countless times where the issues that our customers have brought in have resulted in real bugs and real fixes in the operating system so that nobody else has to feel those in the future.
Yeah, that's definitely. Awesome. Yeah, I definitely know that the debugging team and the Windows Performance Kit teams do listen to the feedback, both Defrag Show and Defrag Tools. They are very active in watching what we're communicating with you guys, and you may not see them on the email thread, but they're aware of what's going on and are addressing the bigger concerns. So I think it's been a really good feedback loop for Microsoft, both shows. I've really been impressed by the diversity of what you've been able to cover.
Yeah, we were talking about that earlier. Like, the kinds of questions that you get are just all over the map.
Yeah.
It is actually nice to get those questions because while I might have a little bit of a lag time before getting the question in the actual show, generally Larry tends to spring them on me pretty quickly.
Yeah.
You know, I've got maybe a 24 to 36 hour time frame, if I'm lucky, from getting a question and trying to figure out what's going on. Or, you know, when folks email throughout the weeks, that obviously gives me much more opportunity to go and do research. But it's actually kind of fun because there are certainly questions that I will get that I don't have an idea of off the bat. Mm. And then I'll go digging and I'll go talking to people and I will go and figure out, you know, what is the actual root cause of this problem? Because a lot of times what folks will come up with are issues of their own making. Yeah. So something has come up and they, first thing they do is they go onto the internet, they go and search for an answer. And I don't know about you, but when I've searched for answers to problems with Windows or computers in general on the internet, the first page tends to be complete bupkis.
Yep.
Misdirection?
Yes. Yeah.
I can't tell you how many times the number of links that I've seen, that you put in an error code, you know, an AV error code, for example, and then one of the first hits you'll get is a link to some site that says, fix this error code now by clicking on this link.
Oh, right.
And it's like, oh, and good Lord.
Some spam site trying to sell you malware.
Exactly.
Something. Yeah.
And particularly some of the registry hacks they tell people suggest that you do.
Yeah.
Completely unrelated to the issue.
Not only is it unrelated, but it's really, really old. Like, it's something that was in XP, so more often than not, the reg hack doesn't even do anything anymore, right? Or what it'll do is enable some extreme backwards compatibility option that is not even relevant anymore, and it could actually open up your machine to more threats because it's never designed to be used.
Right.
Those are just fun, is just trying to tease apart those types of questions and get to the actual root of the matter. And kind of guiding people onto a different path. Like, a lot of times, it's the problems that they have found are things that they've created because of previously bad assumptions.
Yeah.
And it's the whole journey to the initial thought process and trying to change that or trying to redirect it to something that is going to be more future compatible or something that will not cause them future problems.
Yeah. So what I see regularly is people writing emails where they already have the conclusion rather than the scenario. So they have done the analysis and they believe it's a problem with the widget, right? And that the solution is with a widget. And they don't take that step back and, you know, explain the scenario broadly so these experts in Microsoft and in general can, you know, really help you and understand really what the problem domain is. I mean, you see this a lot with the debugging type questions, very narrow focus type questions. Why can't I get this out of the dump file? But they didn't even share the dump file. Like, you're not empowering anybody to achieve anything. And another analogy, and this is a Microsoft no-no, is you ping someone on Skype for Business, or used to be called Link, and you say, hello. It's like,
yeah.
Hello.
All right, is this going to be a question? Right. Or are you just being friendly?
Why are you making me contact switch right now?
Yeah.
Yes, yeah.
Right. So the protocol is type up your entire message. Use shift enter if you didn't enter in the if you've got enter set to auto send. Use shift enter to support that.
Yeah.
Feel free to paste in, you know, lots of text.
Yeah.
And really write it like you would write an email. Actually, write it in email half the time, mm-hmm, rather, yeah, than Link. If it really is that important, sure, write an email, paste it into Link and see what happens. But really, send the email. It's actually quite obtrusive. Not obtrusive, what's the word for it?
Intrusive. Yes.
That's what it was. Assume that someone's not busy. And quite frankly, people are reaching out usually to quite senior people. And the odds are you are quite busy. So, I mean, how much interrupts do you get per day? I know I get a lot.
I am, as numerous people have called me, interrupt driven.
Yeah.
I am nothing but interrupts, which is why I come in so early and leave so late, as I carve out my early part of the days and my late part of the days when nobody else is around, that I can actually get work done.
Actually achieve something.
Exactly.
Or achieve what you're tasked to achieve rather than anything else.
I mean, in terms of like bugs, I am, through our internal database for triaging, I'm going through 20 or 30 a day. Mm. And, you know, on a weekly basis, that's 120.
Yeah, you know? And it takes time.
It takes time.
Yeah.
And, you know, we're talking about, any type of issue, from the, hey, my app doesn't install, to my system doesn't upgrade, this thing crashes, this device isn't working. It's literally this thing is not doing what it's supposed to be doing, and whatever that thing might be tends to roll across my desk.
Yeah. I would assume that the app compat team probably is the most breadth team at Microsoft. Every other team would all be a slightly bit more deeper, and you really do probably have the widest gamut of any team. Because even when it comes to support, you're routed into a particular bucket. It doesn't go through someone generic. It goes, well, this is a file system issue. We'll go to the file system expert. Where you really do have to just know everything. And I assume that's where you're able to, that's the skill set you're drawing from for the defrag show questions, really.
Absolutely. Like, for the years that I've been here, I have played in virtually every stack, right,
yeah,
of the OS, and every single layer, whether it's in kernel, file systems, at the transition between user and kernel, in shell, in COM, in WinRT, file systems, registry, I mean, you name it, there's probably not a stack that I have not written some code in at some point in time.
That's pretty cool.
Bug fixes or shims. Those are our app compat hacks in order to allow apps and even some of our own code sometimes to work correctly as time goes on.
Do you think that the shimming subsystem is something that broadly people need to know about? Or is it kind of one of those things that, you know what, let's leave it to the experts to worry about? Is it something that you really do need to know personally? As a high-level IT pro, blah, blah, blah.
As a high-level IT pro, the thing about shims is that they are system code, right? So do you, as an IT person, need to know about the RTL functions in NTDLL? No.
No.
Do you need to know about the create file functions in kernel 32? all you really care about are the APIs that are documented.
Okay.
Right.
And shim infrastructure is not documented, extensively anyways. The part that IT admins, enterprise in particular, need to know about shims is how to use it to mitigate their own compatibility problems.
Like the App Compat Toolkit.
Exactly. So the App Compat Toolkit exposes our generic shims so that enterprises and even technically home users, because the kit is available to them as well, if they have legacy applications that they need to keep running for whatever reason and they can't fix them or update them, they can use some of our shims in order to bridge a transition between an older OS and a newer OS. And that was really the shims got started primarily in XP and has been fleshed out in XP, Vista, Win 7, throughout all of our OSs. But if you look at it in terms of a curve from when XP first started to now, and think about this graph as if you're looking at it, you had a high end in XP of the number of shims written because you're doing a transition from 9X to XP.
Mm. Right.
And that transition was just massive. Like trying to go from a not quite Win32 system, a lot of 16-bit code, and not a protected mode 32-bit OS to a protected mode 32-bit OS where every process is isolated.
Right.
From 9X to XP, we had a huge number of shims, and then we had shims from XP to Vista because Vista was such a large change from XP.
Yeah, the whole security footprint.
Exactly. But then the number of shims started to drop from Win 7, Win 8, and Win 10.
Now, when you say drop, you mean active shims or ones that we support still? Or?
No, in terms of new shims being written.
Oh, so the addition into the catalog.
Exactly. It dramatically dropped off because...
Was that better programming practices?
Maybe? Yeah, actually that was a lot of things that we drove here in Compat with the rest of Windows and Microsoft in general, is that point fixing applications, shimming applications, just doesn't scale.
Yeah.
You know, you can't ask an enterprise or an individual to apply something to a single XE or a single program when there are literally over 4 million programs on the planet.
Yeah.
And those are individual programs, not XEs. If you're talking about individual XEs at any given time, you're looking at about 20 million.
Yeah.
Wow.
So you can't ask people to do that. So the things that we've driven into the OS are... when you're making changes, you can't break compatibility without having some sort of mitigation option that applies to all applications prior.
Yeah, it's more of a generic approach than a specific approach.
Exactly.
This might be a good time to ask about the version Y and the versioning of Windows. So,
loaded question.
Yeah. So as people might know, may or not know, the version of Windows, the actual one that's reported to the application, actually hasn't matched the version number of Windows for a long time.
Yeah, it was always 6.0 and then 6.1.
2. So Windows 2, 8 was 6.2, 7 was 6.1, Vista 6.0. And going from, and then previously that was 5.2 for XP.
For Server 2003.
Jumping that major version, broke people, right? And that's what the version lie is about. And particularly Vista and 7 and 8 are architected very similar, and that justified that major number staying as 6, and then only the minor changing from 0, 1, and 2. But the decision was made in 10, mainly through a lot of work you did about the version APIs particularly, that we could actually get up to 10, which is really what we wanted to do in the whole time. If we had the choice, we would have gone up 6.0, 7.0, 8.0, but application compat was...
would have broken apps, right?
Yeah.
Well, unfortunately, it's not even just apps that are broken. We tend to demark user mode code as applications and then kernel mode code drivers. Mm. So it's just compat in general, where there's just too much code out there that assumes wrongly that if you are not on a particular version of the OS, that you, like, if it doesn't recognize a version of the OS, that you're automatically on the oldest version. So I've seen case statements where it's literally, major version 4, 5, 6, and then if it falls out into a default, it says, oh, you must be version 4. You couldn't possibly be version 7,
yeah.
Right? Because, hey, that would be too logical.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, what are the chances, honestly, of your application, which was written in 2010, for example, to land on an operating system that was written in 1995?
Yeah.
It's just not going to happen.
And the other one was the if statement, right? You go,
the if statement,
if
yes.
Major is greater than or equal to 6, and minor is greater than or equal to 1, which means 7.0 now is excluded.
Exactly.
Because the 0.1
right.
Is mishandled.
Right.
So what the version Y, by default in Windows 10, it reports?
So the version Y in actually 8.1 is when we switch to what we call the global version Ys. What that means is that in 8.1, we said that if your app is not designed for Windows 8.1, and designed being, are you manifested with an app compat manifest, yep. Or is your PE header set to be Windows 8.1? If neither of those are true, then we assume you to be less than...
To be legacy.
To be legacy, exactly. Right. So we give you back the Windows 8 version.
And this is when you call like get version EX
exactly.
Or those APIs.
Yeah.
You get lied to.
Yes.
Unless you explicitly have said, yes, I am a Windows 8.1 compatible app, right?
Okay. And because the way that inertia works is that you have far, far, far more older applications than you do newer applications. So this just allowed the bulk of apps just to continue working.
So even though the OS is 10.0, as we talk about these days, mm-hmm. they still believe they are running in an 8.0 universe?
Yes, if they're extremely old, they would get back 8.0. If they were manifested for 8.1, they would get back 8.1 in Windows 10.
Yeah.
And if they're manifested for Windows 10, then they will always get the correct Windows 10 version.
Gotcha.
But they have to essentially declare up front that they know about the operating system that they're running.
So in a way, it's kind of putting the onus on the app developer to say what versions of Windows they are tested on.
Exactly.
Rather than us just sort of having to fix their broken version.
Yeah.
And fundamentally, people have used the version as a tangential indicator to feature detection.
Yeah.
Which is absolutely 100% wrong. You should never correlate an arbitrary build of the OS to saying that this feature is present.
Mm.
If you want to look for a feature, go look for the feature and handle failure.
Yeah.
Because there's nothing to say that feature wouldn't be backported. The feature could be removed at a future point in time.
It's not available in that SKU.
Available in that SKU.
Especially now, you've got so many SKUs. You've got IoT.
Yeah.
You've got the nano server. There's all kinds of stuff that aren't there, right?
And even HoloLens. I mean, it's a Windows 10 device, and you know what? There is no UI, traditional Windows UI on that thing.
Yeah, exactly.
So,
you
made a HoloLens. Were you the person responsible for the header files, which made those questions easier? So. Like I was saying with the if statement, people made these terrible if greater than 6 something, something, something.
Right.
You now have a very simple function that says, is greater than something? What's the phrasing?
Yeah, so you're talking about is OS greater than Win7?
Yeah.
Or is OS greater than Win8? That under the hood uses the verify version info API. Which is kind of one of the better APIs to use. And in Windows 10, we noticed that people were still using the Verify Version Info APIs wrong.
Yeah.
Because you can...
Whole feature versus version thing?
Yes. Because you can pair the Verify Version Info as still doing a range check, which... is exactly what we don't want to have happen.
So if greater than Windows 7, if less than
exactly.
Windows 8.1, or equal to 8.1.
So the global version lies also applies to those. So anything when you're talking about version is that if you're going to call those APIs, you have to tell us up front that you're designed for the OS that will give you the answers that you are expecting.
Yeah.
Because if you use the version detection as some sort of support statement, that goes against what we as a platform want to do. What we as a platform will say is that when you write your OS, or when you write your application, it is the OS's responsibility that that application will work going forward. That is our commitment, is that if you are using documented APIs and documented interfaces, and you're not doing anything screwy, like checking the assembly layout of an API within kernel 32, which I will tell you, there are numerous examples of that which cause me nothing but heartburn.
Wow.
You know, if you do things like that, then no, we will not guarantee that it will work in the future. But if you do things correctly, right?
And documented APIs,
and like you're writing an application, you're saying, okay, we want this application to work. We are taking on the support statement that it will work in the future, right? You should not have to worry about it. And if you're doing a version check for nothing more than saying, well, I haven't seen it on that OS before. I don't know if it will work. No, that's not the question that you should be asking. It's the assumption that, yes, my app will work. If my app doesn't work on the future OS, that is our responsibility.
Then you talk to us
and we figure out, what did we do to break your application? Because if you're doing everything right, we shouldn't break you.
Right?
That is our fundamental promise as a platform. So that promise, that contract between us and the developer is, you meet us halfway. You do what MSDN is telling you, right? You do the right thing, and we will honor our half of the contract of supporting those MSDN documented APIs.
I think one of the things that WinRT did really well, really architected this well, is like, just say that you want something like, I don't know, a gyrometer, right? Well, my PC is not going to have a gyrometer. And so instead of crashing you, calling into something, everything's done based on the collection idea. You go, give me the collection of gyrometers, and it says, I have count of zero, rather than, you know, but in other ways you'd go, well, the DLL is missing, or you'd crash, or whatever.
Get some error code.
Yeah,
back or whatever.
And you get a fantastic level of granularity from that every single minute of feature that you need, you can look at that way and make it optional. And so in your contract, you say, yes, I need access to location. And then if there is no location thing, so you've got to say, I am contracted to need this resource. You know, when your phone and your PC says, do you want to authorize this? That contract's there. But it doesn't mean that the device that backs it has to exist on the box. And graceful termination. And I think that's a really good design decision. Does this feature stuff kind of relate to API sets, which is what Larry Osterman worked on?
It does. API sets are an abstraction layer around where does the actual feature live in a host DLL. So that is to get around the problem of saying, do a load library on foo DLL and do a get proc address on bar export, right? That particular issue is that, okay, now when we want to refactor the DLL, so say we're looking at, I don't know, create window EX at a user 32. User 32 is a monolithic DLL. We want to refactor it into something else, right? Well, we have applications that are saying, well, I'm doing a load library and get proc address on this. So if we now move that export into a different host DLL, that app will fail. So what we want to have happen with API sets are you link to an abstracted form of
a framework manifest of a contract.
You link to a contract that is a versioned contract that basically tells you that this API and this API signature exists. That is all that you need to know.
You don't care about where it is.
You don't care about where it is.
Yeah.
And that will, that way the actual implementation can live in a different host DLL wherever it may be. And then you do like an is API present check that will then say, you know, that particular functionality may be factored out of a particular SKU. So you check for an existence of it first. And that way we are able to reduce the number and sizes of our monolithic DLLs into better componentized, more feature encapsulated constructs.
And it helps servicing. You're not downloading a 20 megabyte DLL anymore.
Exactly.
If the base part's solid as a rock, it's solid as a rock, gets downloaded once, 8 megabytes overhead done.
Right.
And the other 12 megabytes which maybe is a bit serviced a bit more. Yeah, it reduces download size. You end up with the same, roughly the same hard drive usage, so it doesn't really hurt you much. But we're doing that across the board. I know Win32K and various other systems are all being split up.
Mm-hmm. Well, it gives us a lot more flexibility in what we're talking about, the SKU variations and things, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, how we sort of build the OS, right?
Overall one core development.
Yeah. Right.
You know, because we want to have as small as possible one core that is then easily pluggable into the devices and additions that are being produced, and then you can just add on top. Yeah. And you just want to have that one common core to be as small as possible.
Mm. So before we leave, I've got to ask you about your rig. You actually have the same rig as I do. I actually put my horizontals next to each other, so I have a much wider stance. But how long have you had four screens, and would you ever live without it?
I've gone down. I had at least seven or eight at one point in time.
Wow.
But I found that I could consolidate. Well, those screens, I have to admit, were much lower resolution.
Yeah, I was about to ask that.
But these are not like 4K displays or anything like that. They're
the
1920s.
Yeah, 1920, I think they are, yeah.
But 1920 by 1200, I believe, resolution.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
And this particular configuration usually works out pretty well. Coupled with virtual desktops, then I literally can get anything done with these four displays.
Yeah, the virtual desktops is kind of comes in handy when you're like me and you have 40 windows open at any one time, and you sort of can allocate them by task a little bit more.
Exactly. Yeah. Like I'll have a desktop just devoted to all my WinDBG sessions.
Yeah, I have that. Mine's definitely that type of scenario. I have Outlook dedicated to that one.
Outlook is on this one. Across all my desktops.
Yeah. Right one tends to be IE, more reference material type stuff. Yeah. Stuff that you want to read
vertically.
Yeah. Really IE. And then if nothing's there, Pandora tends to be docked over there. And then the middle two, like you say, WinDBG, Visual Studio, or Razzle for us.
Right, well, yeah, definitely Razzle for me as well.
Yeah.
Oddly enough, my use of Visual Studio is primarily only for our bug database.
Oh, you do it that way?
Yeah.
For
I use the website for that.
Oh, it's too slow for me.
Yeah. I tend to not have to... it's usually someone complaining about one bug, and then I need to look at all the history, and it's like random stuff, and they tend to give you URLs rather than something.
That's true.
Rather than triaging my own work, it tends to be interrupt driven, like we're talking about.
So Microsoft sort of converted everything. We had a sort of weird internally built bug database.
Actually, we bought it
back.
Product Studio.
It was licensed, but customized. And now, what was it, 3-4 years ago, they converted everything to Visual Studio online. So the Windows bug database is now the same product that we sell to other people to use.
And my team particularly is the people who like to populate it a lot with millions and millions of bugs.
That's right.
So we always get that 1% of people who aren't happy. So there's always that flood of feedback.
Now, I have to ask about the Rhymes with Orange thing, the backstory here, because... it always says when you look up Gove in the address book, in Outlook, it always says orange after it. You have Rhymes with Orange on your signature.
When I first came to Microsoft many moons ago, I had in my email signature Gove Rhymes with Stove because people did not pronounce my name properly. And then later on, I changed it to Gove Doesn't Rhyme with Glove. And then in the early Vista time frame, I changed it to Gove Rhymes with Orange because nothing in the English language has a perfect, proper rhyme with orange. And it's just meant as a non sequitur, just, people reading it going, huh?
It's a tagline.
It would really separate the two people, or the two groups of people. It's like, they would either come and ask me the question, or they would sit there trying to figure it out furiously until they gave up and then just ask me the question. It's interesting because, orange and purple and silver are the only two that I'm aware of in English that don't have a perfect rhyme.
Yeah.
And they're all colors, so what are the odds? Yeah. Very strange. Strange quirks of the English language. But that's one of those things. It's almost like a tagline for you now. People will be like, oh, go talk to Gove orange.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's kind of just the, I've adopted the persona. I mean, the orange glasses.
Yeah, and, you're done with it.
It has oddly become my favorite color.
Oh, really?
Yeah, oh. I just the more that I'm exposed to it, like, at least for the glasses, they help me here at work, because I mean, you'll see that my office has light right now, which is very much not the usual case.
We had to turn the lights on when we came in. It was a cave.
He's a vampire.
Yeah.
I mean, the window's drawn. I don't do well in fluorescent lighting, but also the direct lighting here interferes because I can't see properly.
The contrast problem.
Yeah. But
you know, there's people like me who don't have a window office who hate you.
Yeah, you see these people with the plum window office with the blinds closed all the time. It's like, I'll trade you.
I've been at Microsoft nearly 8 years, and that's not enough to get a window office in this building.
Oh, I just moved to a building. I've been here 18 years, and I moved to a building where I don't have enough seniority to get a window office. So that's bumming me out a little bit.
Yeah,
I should really broker my office.
Yeah, you could probably get some kind of deal
make some money.
Rent it.
Yeah.
Sublet.
Sublet your office. That's a good call.
And I'm assuming I'm guessing you're kind of like me, is that you talk to a lot of people broadly across Microsoft. It's not really the corridor conversations that you're engaged with, right? Or do you have that a bit?
I have it all.
You do both?
Yeah, there's tons of hallway conversations. I try and have more email or link conversations with people, just because, you know, time is precious.
Yeah.
Don't really want to waste an hour setting up a meeting somewhere if we can just hammer it out really quickly in link or something.
And it's also good to have it on record too sometimes.
Exactly.
We're all randomized so much that you need to refresh your memory about, who am I talking to again?
Yeah,
what is this about?
I love email just because of the searchability for it. You know, meetings, they come and go, and not everything is always captured, especially follow-ups.
Yeah.
But, I mean, the thing with me is that I'm reachable anywhere. You know, if you phone my office number, it forwards to my cell phone. I have been woken up at 3 o'clock in the morning by my phone going off because there's some weird-ass bill break that needs to be fixed.
Oh, man.
Yeah. So, you know what, I'll go fix it. I've been... Yeah, it's perpetual on call. I've been one of the few people that usually gets within the last 5 check-ins of a product release for some weird stuff that goes on. I remember I was one of the very last people to get a check-in for Win 7 RTM and Win 8 RTM.
Nice.
Which is both good and bad, I guess.
Yeah,
good and
bad. I was going to say, that's a dubious distinction.
It's very... you know, there's a lot of weight on your shoulders on that one, because if you screw up that one check-in, there is no undoing it.
Especially back then, it was like, no, we're printing up the DVDs now.
Exactly.
This is the bits.
Yeah.
There's no going back at this point, right?
Yeah.
It's not like you can re-roll it after a certain point, back when we did physical media.
So. And obviously, when you get closer and closer to RTM, the importance of the bar goes up and up, and the confidence level you've got to have when you do it gets higher and higher. So willingly changes don't get shoved in at the last second.
No, it goes through an ungodly amount of review, and you have to have, the world literally has to be on fire in order to in order to get those kind of check-ins.
And I think also now in the world of servicing and flighting, we can fix it next week anyway. Where we haven't got this DVD pressing.
It's a little bit easier now.
Yeah.
It's oh, we can get that bug next month, so you can wait.
Yeah. Awesome. Yeah. Well, thanks for catching up. As always, watch Defrag Show and Defrag Tools.
That's right. That's right.
Your Defrag Show is at Microsoft.com.
At Microsoft.com.
And Defrag Tools at Microsoft.com.
And Defrag Show is also on Reddit, so...
Yeah.
So you can message me on Reddit, and I take a look at the threads on Reddit.
Okay.
I have to go add that one. Very
it's
cool.
I guess some interesting ones on there, especially a lot more focused on Win 10. The stuff that on Defrag's show I get is much more focused on Win 7 and Win 8, much earlier operating systems, more legacy stuff.
Yeah, and Tools tends to be focused more on dump files and ETW traces, really. Yeah. Really is what it comes down to.
Yeah.
Well, thank you again. As always, put show notes below. I'm assuming we're going to cross-post this on both tools and show.
So we can do that.
We can work it out. And we will see you next week on Channel 9.
Thanks for watching.